In the weeks that followed, the house without Elena was a different kind of place. Not louder or messier, though it became both, but structurally different. The way a building is different when a load-bearing wall comes down. The lavender she kept on the linens was gone within a week, replaced by the smell of the mill and the particular staleness of rooms that no one was tending to. The kitchen radio went silent. The household's rhythms, which had been hers, simply stopped, and nothing replaced them. Silas moved through what remained like a man who had misplaced something and forgotten what it was. 3 weeks of the same routine, work, home, food that he didn't eat. Thereafter, the routine collapsed and he stopped pretending. The anvil absorbed the hours that the mill didn't claim. Arthur heard him come home late, heavy-footed in the hallway. He tracked the sound the way he always had. The boots. The quality of the silence after them, whether the footsteps paused outside any of the bedroom doors or went straight past. They went straight past. Junior left home without any real discussion. He had applied to the military in private, received his acceptance letter on a Wednesday, and was gone by Friday. At the door, he gave Arthur the handshake of a man leaving for work, firm and brief, but final. He walked down the terrace street without looking back. Arthur watched him go, understanding his decision with clarity. Junior wasn't escaping. He wasn't looking for a way out. He was trading a broken system for a functional one, one that would feed him and tell him where to stand. It was a rational choice that Arthur filed away without judgment as he went back inside. Marcus, however, left in pieces. Items from the home disappeared slowly at first, a toaster, the spare blanket from the hallway closet, and then less slowly. His mother's silver locket, the one she kept in the small dish on her dresser, was gone on a Tuesday morning, just after Marcus had been home the night before. Arthur stood in the doorway of his parents' bedroom and looked at the empty dish for a long time. He said nothing to Marcus about it. The locket was already gone. A confrontation would only take Marcus away faster, and Arthur was not ready for the house to be entirely his own. So, he left food in the kitchen on the nights he knew Marcus was coming. He watched as the time between his brother's visits stretched from days to weeks to months, until Marcus stopped coming home at all. The house had become what it had been quietly becoming over the past 2 years, Arthur's alone. He was 11 when his mother died. He was 12, managing utility accounts under his father's name. He was 13, negotiating with his school district's free lunch program so he could eat one reliable meal a day. He was 14, patching his own clothes with the needle and thread from Elena's sewing kit, which he kept in the bedside table drawer. He had not thrown anything of hers away. He had kept the yellow blanket and the composition notebooks on the shelf where she had left them. He kept the travel books beside them. He kept the chart he had made for his medications, folded small, in the back of the drawer. He could not explain why he kept it. He kept it anyway.
What you're looking for now is not a file, Arthur, but a century of failure in the Colorado River Basin, the result of which is a water crisis of biblical proportions.
He said, his voice dropping into a smooth, melodic drawl that carried the weight of a philosopher rather than an executive.
The network has aggregated every hydrological measurement, legal statute, and consumption metric recorded since the early 20th century, and will provide you with a complete framework of the functional state of the river. The system provides the data set, Arthur, but it remains up to you to provide the perspective of that the numbers alone can't resolve. This should provide you with the factual foundation required for observations that you'll be required to perform on site. Alex paused.
Understand, Arthur, the network has identified this conflict as a major threat to our long-term stability, and because of that, we need to start immediately. You'll need to be prepared by tomorrow morning.
With a final sharp nod, Alex exited the room, the door sliding shut with a quiet exhale. The focus suite settled into silence. Arthur looked at Echo, whose blue orbs were already adjusting to the ambient light, and turned back to the terminal. Arthur sat down. With a flick of his wrist, he began sifting through the layers of the foundational report. The first layer was a historical deep dive into the 1922 Colorado River Compact, an agreement created to divide and regulate the river water among 7 western states: Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and California. The compact had arisen from concerns that the rapidly expanding downstream states, particularly California, would deplete the water supply before upstream states could fully develop their water infrastructure. In response, the seven basin states entered into agreement that divided the river system into two geographic regions, the upper basin and the lower basin. The lower basin consisted of Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, while the lower basin consisted of Arizona, Nevada, and California. Based upon hydrological measurements, negotiators believe the river produced 17 to 15 million acre-feet of water annually, a figure that was vastly overstated by measuring during unusually wet years. Using these figures, however, an agreement was reached appropriating the beneficial consumptive use of 7.5 million acre-feet of water per year to each basin. The screen flickered as Arthur scrolled deeper into the digital archives until the geographic linchpin of the entire legal framework appeared, Lee's Ferry. For hundreds of miles, the Colorado River was trapped inside impassable rock canyons. Lee's Ferry was the single fracture in that geology where the cliffs dropped to water level, making it the only place where people could physically reach the riverbank to cross it. Through the 1922 Pact, this became the invisible boundary between basin states. The finish line where the upper basin was forced to surrender control over the river water to the lower basin. The agreement imposed a rigid delivery obligation on the upper basin, legally binding them to ensure that 75 million acre-feet of water passed Lee's Ferry every 10 years, shifting the entire burden of drought onto the upper basin states. Arthur watched as visualizations of the river's erratic history played out on his terminal, noting how the legal promise of the compact stood in stark contrast to the wild, unpredictable floods that once defined the Colorado River Basin. Chapter 29. I can't do this anymore, Alex, Arthur said, his voice flat, quiet, and completely stripped of the standard vocal compliance expected of him. He walked directly to the edge of the glass desk and pressed his hands flat against the surface, looking straight into the face of his supervisor. I can't be a part of a system that claims it's advancing the greater good while simultaneously destroying so many innocent people through deliberate inaction. Today, we used the death of a child to secure metals, and then we walked away, leaving the very trafficking pipeline that led to that child's torture and death completely functional. If our only purpose is to look into the eyes of these monsters so that we can tax their horrors instead of eradicating them, then our mission suffers from the exact same disease that made this atrocity possible. Alex did not flinch, nor did his neutral and passive expression alter under the weight of Arthur's moral revulsion. He tapped his terminal, causing the scrolling analytics of the global supply chain to cast a soft amber glow. Arthur, I understand you're upset. But by looking at this through such a narrow lens, you are avoiding the full depth of the reality before you. True clarity can only be obtained by stepping outside of your immediate emotional response and recognizing that selective blindness to the complexity of the issue does not eliminate its harsh realities. Alex responded, his voice dropping into a smooth melodic drawl that carried the weight of a seasoned philosopher. Alex stood up and walked towards the expansive glass windows that looked out over the pristine, ordered geometry of the parallax. Humanity has consistently demonstrated that they are incapable of efficiently managing their own resources, infrastructure, technology, and political systems, Alex said. Emotions, entitlement, pride, and ignorance are inevitably create war, famine, systemic corruption, and catastrophic cycles of generational suffering. To circumvent the short-sighted nature of these senseless acts, we must intervene in order to predict and prepare for the inevitabilities of human error to ensure the survival of our civilization. In making those decisions, Alex added, his voice steady, there is always sacrifice. War is never without its victims, but we manage those choices with the greatest benefit in mind, weighing the immediate cost against the collective future, ensuring that the heavy burden of a few lives saved today does not break the infrastructure protecting billions tomorrow.